On January 11th, Aaron Swartz committed suicide at the age of 26. As a teenager, the computer prodigy invented RSS, the technology that allows website updates and the results of internet searches to be automatically delivered to users. He later co-founded the social news site Reddit, and he became a staunch advocate of open access, the free and open sharing of academic information without price or copyright barriers. In his guerrilla open access manifesto, Swartz wrote, quote, "The world's entire scientific and cultural heritage, published over centuries in books and journals, is increasingly being digitized and locked up by a handful of private corporations." He went on to encourage not only the push to change the academic publishing regime, but also, quote, "sneaking through holes and climbing over fences to liberate and share paywalled documents." Swartz faced criminal charges for allegedly hacking into a database of academic journals. If convicted, he could have faced 35 years in prison. Swartz's family have blamed his suicide on prosecutors, and his death has sparked a groundswell in the open access movement. In just over a week, the Twitter hashtag PDF Tribute has been tweeted more than 40,000 times, with links to freely available academic papers, instructions on how to make content available, and articles about Aaron Swartz and the open access movement. Matt Person is Technical Services Coordinator at the MBL Huey Library here in Woods Hole. As such, he manages the library's journal collection and is involved with open access initiatives. And he joins me today to talk about the open access movement. Welcome, Matt.
Thank you, Heather.
We also welcome you to join our conversation. You can give us a call at 866-999-4626. Email us at livinglabradio@wgbh.org or find us on Twitter. So, Matt, let's start with the basics. What is open access?
It's rather simple. Open access, if you think about scientific content and you think about scientists, scientists publish articles. And whether you're talking about science or anything else, we purchase access to information in journals, in magazines, and so on. Open access is the idea that the information is freely accessible to anybody.
And so part of being open access, actually, a few definitions that I've seen, it's not only that it's free of charge, that it has no copyright barriers, but it's implicit that this means that it is online, that this is not a hard copy phenomenon. This is really an online phenomenon.
Yes, the world has changed. There was a time when all scientific content was in print and would have to physically come to a library or physically come to a scientist's office. But in the last 20 years or so, there's a tremendous shift in the availability of scientific content online. For example, at the MBL Huey Library, close to 100% of all of the information that we have available for our scientists is through online journals.
So let's talk a little bit about the where publication and these journals fit into the whole scientific process. I mean, we're taught in school, of course, the scientific process is come up with a hypothesis, test it with an experiment, get a result. We don't talk a lot about the fact that the scientific process isn't really done then until you publish that result, and that a lot of those ideas and the way that cycle keeps going is that people are reading other people's results in these journals and incorporating those other ideas into their own thinking. So obviously these publications are really central to the entire scientific process. And so open access has an opportunity to really, in some ways, change the whole way all of science works. The way that science gets done and the way that these ideas get shared has changed so much over the course of 200 years. How open was the sharing of scientific information, say, 100 or 200 years ago?
Scientific information, originally, if we go back a couple of hundred years, the first scientific publications were written up versions of scientific meetings. And
so we've gone from really just writing up accounts of scientific meetings to now some scientists, I think, are probably publishing multiple, sometimes almost a dozen papers a year. This is really a huge part of the advancement of a scientist in their career, is to be able to publish papers.
That's right.
We've got an email here from Nanette in Falmouth. She says, "When I was teaching at UMass Dartmouth 6 years ago, faculty were dismayed to learn that the university had dropped its JSTOR membership, meaning that students could no longer had access to thousands of scholarly articles that students elsewhere could use. I don't know whether UMass has JSTOR now, but I wonder whether Aaron Swartz's actions were a Robin Hood attempt to address inequalities in access to information and education. And certainly, Nanette, thank you for that email. I think that's quite certainly what Aaron Swartz thought he was doing. He actually, in his Guerrilla Open Access Manifesto, writes, "Information is power. But like all power, there are those who want to keep it for themselves. The world's entire scientific and cultural heritage, published over centuries in books and journals, is increasingly being digitized and locked up by a handful of private corporations." And goes on, of course, to create this manifesto of how that needs to be changed. But Matt, it's interesting, you know, I kind of posed to you the question before we went on the air of was Aaron Swartz, from your perspective as a librarian, as someone who works with these scientific journals all the time, was what he was doing a Robin Hood act of heroism, or was this really just common thievery to hack into JSTOR, this database, and download these articles? And your reaction was something in the middle. You said, well, why did he choose JSTOR? What struck you as odd about this choice that he
made? Thank you, Heather. When this happened, it seemed that it was interesting to me as a librarian because JSTOR is a nonprofit organization, and there are many large publishers that charge a lot of money for people to access their content. JSTOR is more of a reasonable organization. In fact, since the time that Aaron allegedly did this, JSTOR has opened up all of its pre-1923 out of copyright content. And they've also just recently started a program where anybody can access anything in JSTOR three times. You can establish an account, and if you're not connected to a library that has a subscription to JSTOR content, you can then access their content. So now they are partly open access and partly paid subscription. I don't know if Aaron's actions had something to do with that, but it is a reflection of the changes taking place in publishing, that previously commercial publishers are now partially open access. There are some fully open access publishers.
So what would it mean to be partially open access? I mean, that seems like almost a contradiction in terms. How do you be partially open access?
Well, if we take a publisher like Springer or Wiley, these are large publishers. They publish hundreds and hundreds of journals. A library or an individual would pay a certain amount of money for those journals. But now they have options by which scientists can choose to make the article that he publishes in one of these commercial publishers available to anybody. And the way the scientist does that is they will pay a publication fee to the publisher. The publisher then feels that they've received the proper remuneration for the article. And then if you go to the website of a particular journal, some of the articles will be available only to people who subscribe to the article, and other of the articles will be available to anybody.
Obviously, one of the arguments for open access is that the public and other scientists shouldn't have to pay so much to be able to access this information. But what you're saying is that in order to make them open access, the scientists themselves are having to pay that cost to make it available. So is that one of the arguments against open access, is essentially that you're just shifting the cost to scientists themselves?
Well, that's a good point. Whether the costs are shifted to the scientists, very often that cost will be paid for by the funding organization that funds the scientists. Some universities like Harvard have established funds, which are called open access funds, which scientists can then draw upon to publish in one of these open access journals.
I mean, I've heard the argument that taxpayers have paid for research to be done, so taxpayers shouldn't have to pay to read the results. But then if you're saying, well, the scientist is going to have to pay for the publication, and that payment is probably going to come out of the same grant that funded the research, it seems like taxpayers are paying for it either way. Regardless, there's still a cost, essentially, that has to be met in order to publish this information.
That's right, Heather. Somebody once said there's no such thing as a free lunch. And there's
and
very
there's no
few
such
places,
thing as a free article, I guess.
That's right. Although there's very few places in publishing where there isn't a flow of money. And this is a criticism of open access. You want to think it's free. And it is freely accessible to people. But at some point, somebody has to pay the charges involved in the commercial process, the process of producing, taking an article that somebody has written and making it widely available to people. There are some open access publications, mostly in Scandinavia, where the government will offer the cost of publishing the journal. And therefore, these are truly free open access publications. The people who write the articles do not have to pay to have them published, and the people who read them don't have to pay to have them published. But in that case, there still is a transfer of money because the government is paying the journal for their services.
I mean, obviously, even when you're working in the online realm, you still have to pay people to, at the very least, post that content to the web, and there are editorial services that are going on behind the scenes. So there's always a cost, but are the costs less when something is published online, and is maybe an online-only model something that could make open access more more feasible?
I believe that that if a journal is no longer published as a print journal, then the publisher won't have those costs of printing, and they won't have those costs of mailing out journals. But one of the misconceptions about the online environment, people think just because the internet is free, everything is free. But there are extensive costs associated with publishing anything.
You mentioned a minute ago that copyright came about in 1923. So to some degree, does that mean that anything that was published before 1923 is essentially freely available to anyone? It's not covered by the restrictions there?
Copyright existed before 1923, but U.S. copyright law states that anything that was published before 1923 is in the public realm. And so therefore, for example, at the MBL Huey Library, we've partnered with 10 and more than 20 or 30 libraries worldwide to create the Biodiversity Heritage Library, in which we've gone and we've taken all of our pre-1923 physical volumes in the library and we've digitized them and created a library which is the sum total of some of the finest natural history libraries in the world, which is freely accessible to anybody with a computer.
Now, what about the content from 1923 until now? Because even if all scientists tomorrow started publishing in open access, obviously we've got almost 90 years worth of content there that is still covered by copyright that has been published in this, I don't know if you want to call it closed access, but this paywalled system. Is there any way to get around that paywall that intermediate content?
Yeah, it's interesting because if you look at the statistics for what is available open access, you see that there's a big, the top of the graph is big for pre-1923, and then it dips down for the middle of the 20th century. And then as you get closer to modern times, it goes up again. That's partially because there is a history in scientific publication of sharing publications. My dad was a scientist when I was a kid. I used to watch him go through a little publication called Current Contents, which would have all the recently written scientific articles in it, and he'd have a stack of postcards next to him, and he'd write out to scientists whose articles he wanted to read, mail those out, and he'd get the article. That's just one example of the fact that science exists on the concept of sharing information.
Today, you know, still scientists, when you publish a paper, you get a certain number of reprints that you can share, but more and more you get a digital PDF, quote-unquote, reprint copy of your paper that you could share, which essentially means almost infinite sharing. You could send that PDF to anyone that you want. So what is the push for open access beyond that if scientists can freely share their own publications in that way?
Actually, Heather, you're not free to do with whatever you wish to do with the article that you've published. That's because publishers have strict rules and regulations. When you publish in their journal, you don't necessarily retain the rights to the article that you wrote, and you're not necessarily free to freely distribute your article. And one of the things that is happening in academic libraries is to speak with scientists and to try and get them to understand that when they sign the document that releases their article, sometimes they're signing away all the rights to their article. If you're a scientist and you go to the website for the MBL Hui Library, you'll see that there's an opportunity to download a publisher's author agreement, which is an addendum to the agreement that a publisher and an author has to publish that article, in which a scientist can retain more rights to the article that he's written. And this is very much what open access is about. The idea, as we've said, is not to close access to information. The idea is to open access to information because there is not enough money out there for people to redo experiments in science. If you do an experiment in science and you have a result and it's published and another scientist never sees that work, that scientist may go and redo that experiment. This happens on a big scale. That's wasteful, and it doesn't make sense for our society.
I mean, that's reinventing the wheel over and over and over.
That's right.
Is part of the crux of this problem of how to share information broadly is just an expansion of the scientific community itself part of that problem? I mean, you know, I'm thinking if you go back hundreds of years even, there were probably a handful of true full-time scientists in Europe, each with their own patron. And, you know, it was a very small community to be a full-time scientist. We now have hundreds right here in Woods Hole. And so you've got this much larger number of people that you're trying to reach with the results of your experiments.
That's right. Not only that, but the amount of data associated with science grows exponentially every year. How do you handle this? How do scientists all over the world handle a world in which the output of their information used to just be the article, but now it's the article and mountains of data? So that just on a small scale, speaking about Woods Hole, we have different programs related to the library, but also there are programs within the laboratories in Woods Hole that are only concerned with managing data.
I mean, of course, part of the open access movement, the kind of core focus has been getting the published articles available. But there is also a push to make raw data more broadly available. And that has some real pros and cons. I know even here in Woods Hole, there are scientists who have essentially been burned by the system. When you make your data available real time, that means that anyone anywhere could be using that data and perhaps even publishing before you. And this gets back to this issue we were talking about of where publication fits into the whole scheme work of being a scientist, being a career scientist today.
That's right. There's not enough information out there about what open access is all about. We can sit here and say that it's important for scientists to share data, but there are scientists who are nervous that just as you said, that the information that they have created, somebody else might use it. So what comes to mind is in physics and in mathematics, since the early 1990s, scientists have published in journals, and they've also shared their publications in other repositories to an extent where the open access in physics and mathematics is much more advanced than it is in biology or in the humanities, for example, because people have been doing this type of trusting and sharing for decades now. So that's an example of why these changes, while they're all very important, they don't happen overnight.
It's interesting that it's such a social aspect to the adoption of open access and how it's really progressed differently in the different fields. Joel is giving us a call from Brewster. Go ahead, Joel.
Hi. I'm wondering if the Amateur Inquirer has a place to go where you would not be completely overwhelmed or barraged or at a complete loss as to where to go to look for something roughly close to what he's wondering about. Is there,
Joel, I think
website or something that has a catalog?
So, Joel, you're asking, I think, as opposed to just, I think, Googling something and getting an overwhelming amount of information that you don't know what its quality is, if there's a good place that amateurs could go and kind of search the scientific information. I would think that the MBL Huey Library website might be one such place.
That's right. We're a full-service library, and while we serve the scientific community in Woods Hole, we are open Monday to Friday, 9 to 5, and you can come in and go to our website on one of our computers and look into a database. A database aggregates information, very similar to Google, but it's more specific. And there are databases in your public library that also do the same thing. You can ask your librarian at your public library to show you one of the science databases where you can zero in on a particular area of interest and come up with a list of literature that you can then explore.
Now, I want to first of all say thank you to Joel for your call. And if you would like to give us a call, you can do so at 866-999-4626. I'm curious, Matt, that you've talked about the fact that open access has really, this movement has taken off in the past 10 years. At this point, do we have a sense of what percentage of journals or what percentage of articles are open access?
I was looking at some statistics recently. In 2008, about 20% of all scientific output was available in some open access form.
And obviously, part of this, when a scientist publishes their research, it's not just a matter of, okay, I finished the experiment and published it. Part of what has become part of the scientific structure is the prestige of the journal that you're able to publish that in. How are open access journals perceived relative to more traditional journals?
That's a great question. There are the journals that have been around for a long time, and one of the standards that's used to rate journals and one of the standards that scientists look at all the time in terms of the advancement of their career is called the impact factor. The impact factor is run by a private company. It takes 2 or 3 years after a journal has begun publishing for them to establish an impact factor. Impact factors are looked at by scientists. They're looked at by tenure committees. So here's a new way of publishing called open access. There are fewer impact factors, but you want to know something? There's a whole new way of looking at how people use journals.
All right. Matt Person, Technical Services Coordinator at the MBL Huey Library here in Woods Hole. Thank you so much for being here. For more information on the open access movement, how you can join the movement, and some cautionary tales as well, you can visit our website, capeandislands.org. Find Living Lab in the program menu. This is Living Lab on the Point. I'm Heather Goldstone. Thanks for listening.
Living Lab on the Point is produced by Heather Goldstone. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Living Lab on the Point is a production of the Cape and Islands NPR stations, a service of WGBH.